Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Florida oranges continue to play a major role in the U.S. orange juice industry, accounting for about 50% of oranges used in domestic production last season. Historically, Florida oranges have dominated the U.S. Florida orange juice industry, with Florida oranges accounting for around 90% of domestic orange juice production as recently as the 2016-2017 season.
Looking at Florida orange juice production, USDA economic researcher Catherine Weber for Grapefruit.
For grapefruit in 2024-2025, production is forecast at 299 tons, the lowest level since 1922. Grapefruit production is expected to fall year over year in California and Florida. Texas is forecast to account for one-third of U.S. grapefruit production this season. At 100,000 tons, Texas grapefruit forecast is 4% higher than last year.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I make it a practice not to respond to any elected officials' comments, so I don't want to be seen to be doing that. It's just not appropriate for me.
Chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, speaking on Friday to business journalists in Arlington, Virginia.
The situation, I think, is this, and people, when they're surveyed, they are unhappy about the economy. That seems to largely reflect the increase in the price level that happened when inflation was high, 2021, 22, and 23, largely. Inflation is now back down to much more normal levels. Unemployment is low. The economy has been growing, but people are still experiencing that high price level. In other words, prices don't go down. They know they're paying much more for the basic necessities of life, and they're right that they are, and they're not happy about it, and they're right not to be happy about it. So I think that accounts for the negative sentiment. We, of course, we're looking at inflation, which is the change in prices, and we're seeing that that has come down quite a bit, and that, you know, unemployment is actually low. It's sort of very close to measures of maximum employment, and the economy's growing. So all those statistics are good, but you know, the price increases of the past few years are weighing on people's budgets.
But he says the economy does not appear to be in a recession.
Let's start with the fact that the incoming data right through this morning's employment report, which admittedly is from roughly a month ago, the week of March 12th, they took the data in. It still shows a solid economy. Unemployment's still low. I understand the uncertainty that's weighing on people. You ask about a recession. We don't make a probability forecast of how likely it is for there to be a recession, but many outside forecasters do, and many of them have raised the likelihood, albeit from very low levels. It's not something that anybody now is forecasting, or some people are starting to. And so I can't, there's not much more I can say about that. I realize that the uncertainty is high, you know, what we've learned is that the tariffs are higher than anticipated, higher than almost all forecasters predicted. We still don't know where that comes to rest, though, and we're just going to have to see that through.
He says it's important to remember what the Fed does and does not do.
We're driven by, you know, analysis and careful thought and discussion and debate. And the merits of things, we try to stay as far as we can from the political process. We don't look at political cycles or things like that. So, and I think people expect that from us. They expect us to tell the truth, and that's what we're going to do. But at the same time, we don't want to be part of the broader political discussion about the wisdom of policies that are not assigned to us. We're not responsible for trade policy, immigration policy, fiscal policy. We don't comment on those decisions are made by others, and what we do is we use our tools to try to achieve the goals that Congress assigned us, which is maximum employment and price stability. So I like to think that over time we're a source of calm, rational analysis and also of stability. That's really what the business that we're in is providing, financial and macroeconomic stability to the public. That's really our purpose.
And says a good way to keep up with what the Fed is thinking about is through the Beige Book.
The Beige Book comes out sort of mid-FOMC cycle, and it's all the 12 Reserve Banks and all of their incredible context, what they're saying about what's going on in the economy. So if you want to know, you know, you can look at the national data, but if you want to know what's going on in regions and at different industries, you look at the Beige Book. So it's really a critical, critical thing. And actually, the Reserve Bank system that we have is an enormous strength of the Federal Reserve System. We have these 12 Reserve Banks with their own, you know, economics departments and own participants on the FOMC. So that's a great thing to look at.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
It's certainly possible because I do expect on average to see higher prices as we go through the year.
Dr. Darrell Peel is Oklahoma State University Extension Livestock Economist on whether we'll see more movements based on seasonality.
So if the market is trending up, the seasonality that we normally talk about is based on a stable market. So if the market is otherwise not trending anywhere, you see that kind of seasonal pattern. If you have an uptrend in place, then the seasonal lows that might happen in the middle of the year or later may be muted somewhat with that uptrend offsetting part of that.
He also says uncertainty could impact consumers.
The one thing about all this uncertainty that we have out there now, broadly speaking, you know, political, macroeconomic or whatever, is that could impact consumers. So that's probably the biggest threat overall to the cattle industry is just the fact that we might actually, impact consumer demand. We have at least some potential to trigger a recession here. And if that happens, then, we could see some impacts on consumers. It's not really something I'm predicting, and it's been remarkably robust, but, it is certainly a possibility as we go forward.
And though March is now in the rearview mirror, how will we remember March 2025?
March was again, pretty impressive. Generally speaking, the markets were very strong across the board, whether we're talking feeder cattle or fed cattle or even cull cows for the most part. We've just seen very strong markets. I think the supply fundamentals, which might have gotten masked a little bit earlier with, particularly with some of this external volatility, if you will, really kind of came back into prominence in March and really kind of carried the day.
And what can we expect moving forward for cattle on feed?
Particularly if we look at something like cattle on feed, and we did see a sharp pullback in placements in February, which was very bullish to the market. Some of that probably will be offset in March. As I look at the auction volumes through March, now that we've closed out the month, those volumes were higher compared to last year. They were down in February, which matched the low placement number. Now, this is Oklahoma auction volume, so it's not everything, but sometimes is an indication. And so I say all that to say that placements may bounce back up. I think in general, we're going to see cattle on feed numbers come down over the next few months. It's been slow to do that up until now, but I do think it will happen. And so, it doesn't pay to get too excited about 1 month's cattle on feed report. Sometimes you have to look at 2 or 3 months at least to get a sense of kind of how they average out. A lot of times if you have a change in placements by a week, one way or the other on the end of the month or the beginning of the month can kind of skew those numbers for 1 month relative to last year.
And what about wheat pasture cattle?
Well, first of all, on wheat, if there are cattle still out on wheat now, at least in Oklahoma, we're past first haul of stem. So that means that wheat is for graze out. I do think that's happening. The numbers were not large. We never did get a lot of cattle out on wheat last fall. We had so much trouble getting it started. But there are some cattle out there. So they'll be coming off in mid to late May. And so there'll be that. But again, I don't think they're going to show up as a big run of wheat pasture cattle, if you will. That might have been part of what we saw in March with the bigger volumes was some cattle coming off of wheat. It's not unusual to see that. So, but as we go forward, the bottom line and really the question that's been out there for many months and still is are we retaining heifers? If we start holding back heifers, then those feeder volumes are going to drop pretty sharply, pretty quickly. And that'll show up then in the cattle on feed inventories. It'll pull those down in just a few months' time.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Looking across many indicators, the labor market appears to be broadly in balance and not a significant source of inflationary pressure.
Speaking on Friday to business journalist in Arlington, Virginia, Chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell.
This morning's jobs report showed the unemployment rate at 4.2% in March, still in the low range where it has held since early last year. Over the first quarter, payrolls grew by an average of 150,000 jobs per month. The combination of low layoffs, moderating job growth, and slowing labor force growth has kept the unemployment rate broadly stable. Turning to the other leg of our dual mandate, inflation has declined sharply
consistent with our 2%
inflation of mid-2022. It has done so without the kind of painful rise in unemployment that has often accompanied periods of tight monetary policy that are needed to reduce inflation. More recently, progress toward our 2% inflation objective has slowed. Total PCE prices rose 2.5% over the 12 months ending in February. Core PCE prices, which exclude the volatile food and energy categories, rose 2.8%. Looking ahead, higher tariffs will be working their way through our economy and are likely to raise inflation in coming quarters. Reflecting this, both survey and market-based measures of near-term inflation expectations have moved up. By most measures, longer-term inflation expectations, those beyond just the next few years, remain well-anchored and consistent with our 2% inflation goal. We remain committed to returning inflation sustainably to our 2% objective. Turning to monetary policy, we face a highly uncertain outlook with elevated risks of both higher unemployment and higher inflation. The new administration is in the process of implementing substantial policy changes in four distinct areas: trade, immigration, fiscal policy, and regulation. Our monetary policy stance is well positioned to deal with the risks and uncertainties we face as we gain a better understanding of the policy changes and their likely effects on the economy. It is not our role to comment on those policies. Rather, we make an assessment of their likely effects, observe the behavior of the economy, and set monetary policy in a way that best achieves our dual mandate goals. We have stressed that it will be very difficult to assess the likely economic effects of higher tariffs until there is greater certainty about the details, such as what will be tariffed, at what level, and for what duration, and the extent of any retaliation from our trading partners. While uncertainty remains elevated, it is now becoming clear that tariff increases will be significantly larger than expected, and the same is likely to be true of the economic effects, which will include higher inflation and slower growth. The size and duration of these effects remains uncertain. While tariffs are highly likely to generate at least a temporary rise in inflation, it's also possible that the effects could be more persistent. Avoiding that outcome would depend on keeping longer-term inflation expectations well anchored, on the size of the effects, and on how long it takes for them to pass through fully to prices. Our obligation is to keep longer-term inflation expectations well anchored and to make certain that a one-time increase in the price level does not become an ongoing inflation problem. We'll continue to carefully monitor the incoming data, the evolving outlook, and the balance of risks. We're well positioned to wait for greater clarity before considering any adjustments to our policy stance. It is too soon to say what will be the appropriate path for monetary policy. We understand the benefits of a solid economy where workers can find jobs and inflation is low and predictable. We also understand that elevated levels of unemployment or inflation can be damaging and painful for communities, families, and businesses. That is why we at the Fed will continue to do everything we can to achieve our maximum employment and price stability goals.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
There was COVID. There was also then, and the response to COVID. Then there was high inflation. And then there was soft landing. And then there was, and now we have new administration and changes in policies. And every situation, you know, it kind of rhymes, but it's not exactly the same thing.
Chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, speaking Friday to business journalists.
What we face is what I mentioned in my remarks, is you actually have risks for higher unemployment and higher inflation, and that's difficult for a central bank because our tools, which consist of interest rates, you know, either slow down or speed up the economy over time. And, you know, higher unemployment would call for speeding up the economy and higher inflation would call for slowing it down. So you can be in a situation, if we find ourselves in that situation, we look at how far each of the two variables is from its goal, and we ask ourselves, how long would it take to get back? And we weigh those things and make a decision about what to do. But there's no question that's a different situation, very difficult situation. When we faced high inflation, it was painful for the country, painful for the people that we serve, but we knew what policy needed to be. We knew we needed to raise rates quite a bit. During the pandemic, we knew what we needed to do. It was very clear the direction that we needed to take with force, and we did. The two goals are, as we say, in tension, or they may be. I'd say that's not what we're seeing right now, but it's the effects at the margin right now would be for higher inflation and perhaps higher unemployment. But that's a marginal effect. I would say you're not in a situation like we were in the 1970s, where the two goals were really both pulling in opposite directions and required. It's just very hard for a central bank to be the answer to a situation like that. But that's not the situation we're really in today.
says the Fed is so much more than just him.
So I'm very proud to work with the people I work with. I can tell you that in times like this, or times like the pandemic, where the, you know, the global financial markets were shutting down, the global economy was shutting down, people step forward and they say, we've got this. These are career people who were here for the global financial crisis. They've got 25 years, 35 years of experience with crises, and they step forward and they, it's just incredible what they can do and how good they are. It's a great honor to work with them. So right now isn't that situation. You know, we have the situation we have. So, you know, our trade people and our inflation people and our macroeconomists are all working hard to, you know, to kind of digest the news of this week and try to filter that into the forecast that they'll make. And policymakers are doing very much the same thing. And we're reading everything we can about what's happening and lots of outside analysis, too. We don't have an FOMC meeting until May 6 and 7. So that's really a process that lasts several weeks, but and we're not quite at that stage yet. But we're kind of thinking ahead to that, and working through all of that. I will say though, you know, it feels like we don't need to be in a hurry. It feels like we have time.
Really?
To yes, it feels like we don't. No, I mean it's like I said, you have inflation is going to be moving up and growth is going to be slowing. But it isn't really. To me, it's not clear at this time what the appropriate path for monetary policy will be, and we're going to need to wait and see how this plays out before we can start to make those adjustments.
And why the purple ties?
At the beginning, the only significance was that I like purple ties.
Okay.
But I will say, you know, so then the next press conference, I reach for a blue tie or a red tie, and I go, maybe not, you know. And so I wind up wearing purple ties. And then it becomes a thing, and now I definitely wear purple ties all the time.
Okay.
But I felt like, you know, it just felt a little awkward to be wearing one that was identified. We are strictly non-political. I can't stress that enough. We are not, it's not that we're bipartisan. We are non-political. We don't do that. And so purple is a good color for that.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
You know, this example that I have really kind of starts off with a basic problem that the textbook poses to students. That is, you buy inputs in 1 year, you produce in the next year, you sell some of your output that year, and you sell the rest of it the next year.
Dr. Corey Walters is a University of Nebraska at Lincoln associate professor of ag economics. Talks about helping train students using real-world examples.
And you might not even sell it. You might even use it yourself. And how do we evaluate profitability when we have three different calendar years and we have some cash sales and we have really purchases of product ourselves? We might feed it to livestock if we're talking about corn. So that's the first place where we see that accrual accounting helps us really define profit for one enterprise like corn in this pretty realistic scenario. So the example that we have today, though, is bigger. It's about investment analysis and financial feasibility of making decisions about expanding operations and how that affects both profitability, solvency, and cash flow.
Two types of accounting, cash and accrual. What are the differences?
You could say that there's one rule for both. If it's cash accounting, we're going to record it if cash is exchanged. So an example would be we sell grain for cash. We're going to write that down. It happened. It's pretty obvious. But if we purchase fuel on account, well, we didn't pay any cash yet, and we may be using that fuel to dry grain that has moisture contents that are too high in 2024, and we pay the bill in 2025. So the expense happens in 24, but we pay it in 25. Accrual accounting says, no, cash is nice, and we're going to pay attention to that. But our one rule is to record economic events. If something happens, there is a way to record that. And in the fuel drying example, it would be accounts payable. We'd recognize the expense right away and show that we owe somebody some money.
And admits profitability on paper may not reflect real-world situations.
A big thing is just knowing what you want to do in advance. So if you read the article, you'll see that there are some giant assumptions that are made, and that's to really highlight what's happening and to make this understandable to students. But if this is a matter of we want to expand our farm, we want to buy land, we have to plan ahead of time, because even at lower levels of financing like 60%, it's likely in higher interest rate environments that these projects are not going to cash flow. So we have to think about expanding operations when we have other operations that can backfill that lack of liquidity for our new investments.
On funding expansion and improvements.
Well, the back end of the article talks about opportunity cost. You know, where are we taking self-financed funds from? Are they available? Might be the first place that we need to think about. But as I hinted earlier, interest rates are now at what I would call a normal level. You know, neither one of us are really old enough to remember normal or high interest rates. You know, when we were young, we had normal interest rates, but we don't remember truly high interest rates. So these interest rates that we're borrowing money at now, we have to be much more careful about identifying the best use of those borrowed funds. So I think that actually is going to reward our operators that are the best decision makers, and having a good mind for financial analysis and a framework to help us through some of these really not simple problems is going to be very useful.
This is Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
It's a big deal. And the reason for that is really about what we send where.
There's been quite a reaction to the trade tariffs from President Trump. Ethan Lane, Senior Vice President, Government Affairs, National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
We have the best beef eating market, the best consumer market in the world here in the United States. That's why other countries want to ship their beef into the United States. We eat a lot of beef. We enjoy beef. We celebrate beef. It's a great place to sell beef. And we sell the vast majority of our beef here at home, because why wouldn't we? We don't, however, have huge markets for things like offal, things like tongues, you know, variety meats. Those have a far bigger market in other parts of the world. In Asia, for instance, they really enjoy tongue. They use it in a lot of different menu items. They love that high-quality fed product that we're able to provide them at scale. And it's a value add for us here in the United States as well, because it allows us to sell those products at a much higher price and maximize the value on each carcass in the supply chain. The other side of that is, you know, obviously we don't, with that fat cattle footprint here in the United States, produce enough lean trim to meet the ground beef demand. So what we import by and large is vastly just lean trim. About 75%, give or take, of what we import is to meet that lean trim demand here in the United States market. But that's got to be a symbiotic relationship where you're shipping out things you have too much of and you're bringing in things you don't need, or that you need more of, in order for that to make economic sense. You know, if people were trying to ship more ribeyes into the United States, that's really not going to be a good fit, because, you know, we produce the best ribeyes in the world here already. That's sort of, you know, case in point with the Australians, where we have had a bilateral trade relationship, a free trade agreement with them for 20 years now. And in that time, they have built a market, and they have shipped billions and billions of dollars worth of beef into the U.S. market while continuing to stonewall our access into their market. They're now very excited about their Wagyu market in the United States. Well, gosh, we have a fantastic Wagyu market growing here in the U.S. And, you know, if you haven't tried Texas Wagyu, or, you know, Wagyu that's being raised around the country, or Snake River Farms up in Idaho, you don't know what you're missing. And the Australians are dead set against allowing us to compete in their market on products like that. So, you know, you have to be looking for those areas where it's not an economically viable relationship, or that there's a mismatch. And certainly some of those have come to light as part of this trade conversation.
When it comes to trade policy, what are cattlemen looking for?
More market access to more foreign markets in order for us to continue to grow our footprint in that area. That is profitability for the U.S. cattle producer. There's more than $420 in profit in each fed carcass right now attributable to exports in the U.S. supply chain. And most of that is going to the cow-calf sector. That is the best scenario we could possibly imagine. We want to make sure we're growing that market. We want to make sure we're finding new places to send our product. We want to make sure we're connecting with consumers in new parts of the world, and we want to make sure we're sending more of what those consumers like to areas that are already getting it. That's how you grow this industry. That's how you create more opportunities for producers around the country. That's how you keep more people on the farm and ranch. That's how you make this industry viable for the next 50 to 100 years. So that's what we're looking for from this administration is we don't love tariffs. We would love no tariffs so that we could just compete, because when we compete with the high quality product that our producers raise, we win. Everywhere we go in the world, we raise better beef than anyone else on planet Earth. And when we're allowed to compete, we win.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
A reminder to producers, April 15th is the election deadline for coverage under USDA's flagship Farm Safety Net programs, agricultural risk coverage, and price loss coverage.
You have the ability to change what you had for the 24 production year for 25 if you choose.
Farm Service Agency Administrator Bill Beam says even if producers elect to keep the same coverage as the prior year, they still need to visit their local FSA office to enroll and to assist in decision making.
Lots of tools out there. Various land grant universities have tools.
Producers can also enroll for ARC or PLC online.
Visit fsa.usda.gov.
The FSA website and local offices also have information available, such as eligible commodities covered and how enrollment in either ARC or PLC might impact eligibility for crop insurance products. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.